Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooton, Judge Johnson, Judge Riley, the Honorable Carol A. Hooton presiding.
Good afternoon. This is the case in the matter of the welfare of the children of HWS and DTW. This is the only case on our afternoon calendar. And counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I do want to remind the parties that this is being recorded and that it will be available to the public, so you may want to be careful about how you refer to any of the parties. Either you use their initials and or call them mom, dad, and children. With that, I think we are ready to begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. John Mack for the appellant. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you very well. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to concentrate in my time before the court on the best interests of the children. I'm not conceding that the grounds exist for termination, but I think it's much more important to focus on what I think is most important here. And I think the great error
Mr.
that
Mack,
the court...
Mr. Mack, yes. before you get into it, which of the three issues in your brief does this oral argument relate to?
Number two.
Okay, thank you.
I think the greatest error made by the lower court in this case is one that cannot be rectified by this court today, namely finding that DW did not lose his parental rights and, in fact, was ultimately dismissed from the CHIPS petition. And the problem is DW is married to the mother. No divorce has taken place. Obviously, it would be Eliundi the record to say where they're living or whether they're living together now, but they certainly have the potential to do so. So the great problem is there is probably going to be a household in which one of the parents retains parental rights and full control and custody of the children, and the other, who lives with them and lives with the children, does not. And the tragedy of that is the record is replete with all kinds of problems indicating DW's prior problems, a rape, many abusive actions to the mother, several OFPs, bruises being seen on the mother, complaints made by social workers about the father, and so forth. This is,
Can I stop you because I'm a little confused, because you said that this is your point number two.
The
heading on that is the district court erred in prohibiting HW from having any contact with the children without the approval of the court, or KCHS.
Yes, I apologize. It is one.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that we're on the same page.
I was going to ask you about your statement that the dad was a sex offender. And I know that there is testimony about that, but if you look at page 6 of the order, addendum 6, paragraph 20, the judge seems to say that there really wasn't enough testimony for the judge to determine what actually happened. She says at the end, the only fair information to glean was that dad completed sex offender treatment and is no longer registered as a sex offender.
But he was charged and convicted with a sex offense.
I'm just wondering if there's that evidence in the record or if it was just the social worker's testimony.
Well, of course, there would be evidence of the record of his conviction because he acknowledged it and was still on conditional release, even if he was no longer a registered sex offender. He himself indicates that the court has control over him as a result of the offense. And I think we should look at, when we're looking at the father, page 2 of my reply brief, I lay out the various problems with him. The social worker says he has gone to domestic abuse program for abusing Ms. He has an order for protection that actually would still be in effect, but the mother dismissed it, told me the mother would kill her, the father would kill her, that he would leave the children motherless. He's been physically abusive to the children in their direct statements said directly to me. The girls told me on numerous occasions that they've been physically abused. This is social worker testimony regarding what the children have told her.
But so, but aren't you talking really about issues of credibility? And the judge made some determinations regarding credibility here.
Let me say this about
that.
And
how do we as a reviewing court, how are we able to overrule judges' determination regarding credibility?
Ordinarily, you would be right, but there is one exception, and that's if the evidence is overwhelming that the judge is wrong. And the credibility determination that I submit, the overwhelming weight of the evidence shows to be wrong, are the, quote, retractions, unquote, made by the mother in this case. The things that the mother was saying are simply incredible, the things that she was saying on the stand. When you look at page 2, when you look at page 3, for example, Tamara Thompson, I have concerns over whether or not the domestic violence and the power that Mr. W. tends to wield over her, whether that was by providing her with cocaine, by threats of violence, threats of killing her, that she has made in her protection cases. And I submit, here's the problem. The mother is sitting there in the trial, right next to the father. The father is on the stand, or she is on the stand, glaring into each other's eyes. This is a case of what I call the Stockholm syndrome, the tendency of women who have been abused to fear their abuser and forgive him. One of the better pieces of evidence, for example, was from Ms. Thompson when she said, on the average, 7 times a woman will go back to her abuser before either she finally leaves him or he kills her.
Mr. Mack?
So, yes.
Did the mother give this testimony recanting her prior statements on direct examination or otherwise?
She gave it on direct examination, I believe.
I mean,
well, it's hard to say that because she is subject to cross-examination before she goes to direct examination.
I should ask, was she being questioned by her own attorney or, you know, or was she being questioned by another attorney in the case?
Another attorney and to some extent by the judge. She says lies, all lies, and the judge and the other attorney repeat each of the allegations she made against her husband, and she says lies, all lies, of course, looking into her husband's face as well.
And then did her attorney attempt to address the issue further on redirect examination or further examination, whatever is the label?
No, Mr. Mueller did not, and probably for a good reason. If your client is making a number of statements under oath, you don't want to turn her into a perjurer.
The gist of my questions, if I may, is that it seems like you're asserting that the district court erred for not looking out for her best interests, and it seems like for the mother's. It seems like you're urging us to find that the district court erred by taking her testimony at face value, but without considering other factors. But it just seems like that type of concern could have been dealt with by her trial counsel, who should have and could have been, if that was the case. What did her trial counsel do to try to ameliorate this evidence from your point of view and to persuade the district court to do otherwise?
I don't think that he directly addressed it, but I have a lot of sympathy for him here. Here his client is saying a number of things on the stand that are going to hurt her badly because it's clear that what she's been saying for the last 4 or 5 years were the opposite of what she was testifying to under oath. But if he tries to ameliorate it, he saves her from the termination at the risk of perjury. I don't know what he could have done. I don't know what I would have done.
Well, but the same judge who presided over the TPR trial also presided and signed the order for protection. So sat on that hearing, heard her testify, and that was back in 2016, right?
Right, and she dropped that at one point.
Right, but the judge had some familiarity with your client.
And frankly, she didn't believe my client. But of course, when two people say, or one person says something that directly contradicts something that they've said before, there's got to be some suspicion. But the question is, if she didn't believe my client, which was more likely to be believed? What she said on the stand, which was nonsense, or what she'd been saying for the last 2 or 3 years, which was verified by other people? I'd like to turn to the issue of what are we going to do in the best interests of the child when the child is in a family where the father has full rights and the mother has been TPR'd and they're around the same children. That's a terribly dangerous situation, and it's particularly a dangerous situation where the father is given absolute control over the mother. The father, if for example, the mother sees the children being abused, what's she going to do? If she goes to the police, they're going to say, your rights have been terminated. So sad. And I think that leads off automatically to issue two, which I indicated in this case. And that is that, excuse me just a minute to make sure that I'm on the right page and don't make the same mistake. The district court erred in prohibiting the mother from having any contact with the children without the approval of the court or Candio High Family Services. The problem with that order is it did not survive the TPR, and it did not survive the closing of the CHIPS case. The CHIPS case, by the way, has been closed. The court can verify that by looking at the Minnesota Registry of Actions. So the father now has full parental rights in the children and not subject to any order of the court unless he does something wrong in
the
future. But
is there anything in our record on appeal here with regard to that fact?
No, but court can take judicial.
How can we consider that?
Because the court can take judicial notice of public record, and the Minnesota Registry of Actions is public record, and it's before the court for precisely that reason. And it will say in the top of it, case closed. But even assuming that the court doesn't buy that, and I think that it should, the possibility obviously exists that at some point the permanency is going to be through, the case will be closed, and at that point the father will have absolute rights over the children, provided he doesn't abuse them again and he obeys the law. I quoted Pierce versus Society of Sisters because that case stands for the proposition that if parents act legally, they have absolute rights to control their children, to bring them up as they see fit, and to let them have contact with whoever that parent might want to have contact with. So suppose dad says, okay, mom, I want you to have full contact with their kids. They're your kids after all, even though legally she's not your mother. What's that going to do to the kids? Imagine 5-10 years later, and dad, who is no paragon, gets mad at mom and says to the kids, hey kids, she's really not your mother. The court threw her out, but the same court said that I'm perfectly fit to be a father. That's a terrible situation to leave the children in. Or consider the issue of discipline. Suppose mom says, dad, your discipline is being too harsh or inappropriate. What's he going to say? He's going to say, shut up, you have no rights in this child.
Mr. Mack, it almost sounds like your argument on appeal is that the district court erred by not terminating father's rights.
The truth is, I think they did, but this court can't do anything about it because nobody appealed the error in the court in not terminating the father's rights.
Well, your client could have appealed it.
Couldn't have appealed his. I don't think my client has the right to appeal the fact that father wins, because that's exclusively a right given to the county. If the county had said, yes, the judge erred in keeping father's rights, that could be on appeal, and that would be something that the court could hear, but they didn't. I don't know why. I think that that was a terrible mistake. But what I think the court erred is finding, having found that the father is a fit parent and giving him all his rights, it should not have terminated the mother's rights. The other error I think that the court did, frankly, was closing the Chip's case after the appeal happened, because that gives the court no control over certainly the father and arguably the mother if this court decides not to reverse.
But your appeal is from the TPR. How could we possibly deal with the issue of whether the Chip's case should have been closed after the TPR hearing or not as a reviewing court?
I don't think this court can deal with it, but I think it shows the danger of what the court did in this case by keeping father's parental rights, knowing that at some point he'd have full control, and frankly he does, but taking away all the rights of the mother who's going to be living with him and the children. Thank you.
All right. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Please the court. Shane Baker, Canyonway County Attorney for the county. Probably don't have much for additional arguments than my brief. Summarize them though. Basically, the heart on issue one is that this is the court's, they're given great deference in making these fact-finding decisions in child protection cases. And that's what happened here. The court had testimony from the mom saying that the domestic abuse allegations were all lies. She had the judge had the opportunity to assess credibility. She made a factual determination. Whether the county agreed with that or not is really not the point here. This is the great authority that the district court has, and it's not the court of appeals role to basically retry the case again. And that's since the county's issue on that. Mr. Mack presents a lot of, I guess I'd call it speculation about what could happen, that they will actually live together. We don't know that, certainly not in the record, but even if it did, county could, one possible issue is the county say is that the dad is allowing the children to be subjected to a person who's had her rights terminated, that could create a danger. Possible, does it in that situation? We don't know, but that's more speculation. We don't know what's gonna happen there. Second, I think the appellant is basically arguing for a rule that you have to either terminate both parents' rights or no parents' rights in any case. And I don't think there's no law on that issue either. Mr. Max wondered why the county didn't appeal. It's basically the same issue we have here. It's the court does have great deference in making these determinations. One of the fact findings is on the father's number 27, where the judge says, he's done everything the county asked him to. I don't know how I come before the court. That'd be the interesting appeal. If I appealed from the father's termination, they appealed from the fact that the mom was terminated. On one hand, I'm trying to say, don't listen to the judge. She completely messed up in finding her facts on dad, but she got it all right on mom. That would literally be double talk. We were stuck with the fact that this judge made the decision. She terminated on one, but not the other. And that is what the case law pretty much says. It's the district court's discretion. Now, appellant doesn't come here with additional information that she herself says, I did make this up. This is all speculation on the appellant attorney's part or trying to say what's in the record shows that it was a lie. Now, frankly, it'd probably be a great situation for a county to be in to say, when we brought in any case involving domestic violence, to have a fallback position that the court should never believe someone who takes a stand and says that's made up, because of course the court should take the position that they're recanting because that's the dynamics of domestic abuse. I don't think it's that simple. And I don't know how you discount as a reviewing court when the district court relies on the testimony provided by the appellant. On issue two, the contact, I think the case or the statute is pretty clear that the court has jurisdiction on contact. It's right in 260C.317 that it includes issues of visitation. And it seemed to be inherent in the district court's authority. If they're going to terminate rights, they get to terminate all rights, and all rights include contact. The way appellant's argument in the written brief make it sound like is that there's additional procedural rights, that it just only the automatic right of contact. No, you have to have an evidentiary hearing and due process and all that. That's what the TPR trial is. That alone sets up whether there's any rights after for contact. I'll admit there are going to be problems with when you have one parent's rights terminated and one's not. But we don't know if they're going to be together, when, if at all. And that doesn't mean that some of the arguments in the reply brief were, well, if mom sees abuse, she can't tell the cops about that because she has no rights. Well, she could report any crime or child protection matter to child protection or law enforcement. There's nothing that makes her have to have rights that would prevent that. And then the county could investigate it as it regards to the dad in that situation. Even if the court were to find on the issue of the contact, I don't think that grants the relief appellant's requesting. She's saying that because the court exercised jurisdiction on contact, that the TPR decision should be reversed. At most, that would be just remand to address the contact issue, not to reinstate her parental rights. And then my brief did cite to their third issue was regarding the mental health issues, and I'll leave my brief to address those issues. Then I just wanted to point out, again, the appellant was questioned why the county didn't appeal and made notice of that there was the palpably unfit that the court didn't rule on. Well, let's see, Supreme Court case SZ 547 Northwest 2nd 886. The issue of providing reasonable efforts applies to that TPR factor as well. So when the judge here said the county had not made reasonable efforts, that would cover all the grounds the county applied, even whether the judge adjusted specifically as it related to the unpalpably unfit grounds or not. I have nothing else if the court has questions.
Any questions?
All right. No, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I wouldn't argue for a moment that a court in a TPR or a CHIPS case can't make a no-contact order. Of course it can. What I'm arguing is that such an order cannot survive the closure of the case. And the authority I submit for that is Minnesota Statute 260C.317, which indicates what happens with regard to termination of parental rights. And there's nothing in there that gives the court the authority to make a permanent no-contact order. The statutes that deal with no-contact orders, such as orders for protection, orders for harassment, Danko orders, and the like, are specific to allow a no-contact order. There's nothing in the 260.01 to 260.17 series that gives a court any kind of authority to make a no-contact order which survives the CHIPS petition. Secondly, I'd like to note that with respect to the reasonable efforts aren't the whole of the story, where one of the challenges that the court gives to these people is that they may be palpably unfit. In this case, there was an allegation of palpable unfitness on the part of the father. It wasn't addressed, and had it been addressed negatively, it wouldn't have mattered what efforts the county made, because a palpably unfit parent is not entitled to have reasonable efforts. One of the hypotheticals that the county referred to is that dad might be in trouble with the county if he lets a person who has rights terminated live with him. I don't see how that could possibly get him in trouble, provided the children are well provided for. That isn't a ground for CHIPS, and it isn't a grounds for termination. And there are a good many parents, usually foster parents or step parents who do live with a person whose parental rights have been terminated, and they are not therefore either terminated or even subject to CHIPS or termination. Thanks.
All right, thank you very much. Any questions? All right, we will take the matter under advisement and issue an order within the statutory period of time. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be on an expedited basis.